It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangehamps. If hate moved in next door, would you know it? Would you recognize it?
My name is Edgar Feuchtwanger. I am 93, so I wasn't born yesterday. I think he moved in 1929. I was 4 or 5. I was always taken for a walk by my nanny. She was called Rosie. And just as we passed his front door, he came out. He wore a trilby hat, as people wore in those days. He looked at me quite benevolently, lifted his hat a little bit, and got into his car. People saw him, and they shouted, Heil Hitler. I knew it was some important chap who wasn't very good for us, let's put it that way. Through the lattice fence, you could see Hitler lying in a deck chair in the next garden. And the maid didn't like it, that Eva Braun, sun-bathed with nothing much on the roof of her house. And it all sounds so cozy, doesn't it? Cars came and went. People said, this is Goering, this is Chamberlain, Mussolini, etc. One could no longer walk past his front door. One had to stay on the opposite side of the road. We had no idea that Hitler was a man who killed people by the millions and turned the whole world upside down. That one couldn't imagine at that point. Yes, we were Jewish. We were there living just under his nose. At school, I had a teacher. She was called Fräulein Weichel. She was straight away an enthusiastic Nazi. She immediately dictated to us all the Nazi stuff. That drew Germany awakes and the sun rising with a swastika on it and all this sort of thing. It's in the exercise book, which I still have. We were told, she's your teacher, do what your teacher tells you. And so I did it. My father was a publisher. He was driven out of that and became a sort of full-time Jewish person. And he somehow thought this was a state of affairs that could continue. It was a little bit like going back to the ghetto, but of course he couldn't imagine the brutality and the length to which the whole thing would go. My parents knew something nasty was going to happen. Sure enough, the very next morning they came and took my father away to the concentration camp Dachau. They came with great packing cases to take his library away, and they called this process making secure, sicherstellen, which was simply another word for stealing it. I've forgotten now exactly how it was when he came back. He was in very bad shape. He had to stand up all the time, you know, in the freezing cold. If you fell over, they just finished you off. He was not in particularly good health, but he just about managed to get through it. That was remarkable, I think. Arrangements were made that I would go to a family in England. I was taken by my father near the Dutch border, and just before the train crossed the border, SS guards came through the train and they asked my father why didn't he emigrate as well. He said he was preparing to emigrate, but he then had to go back to Munich, and I crossed the border into Holland. When I reached the sea, I couldn't see the sea. It was already dark, but I smelt it. And I felt I was leaving an evil empire.
Edgar Voigtwanger made it to England in 1939. His mother and father got there a few months later. Edgar, you had a career as a historian, and you had this remarkable personal window on world history, but you didn't write about it until you were in your late 80s. How come?
I was in a completely different world, and I didn't really want to write about something like that, which was so distasteful to me. And of course, now everybody is interested in it. Now everybody wants me to recall it in every conceivable detail.
And what do you want people to take away from your story? What do you want them to think about?
They've got to be careful what they vote for, you know. What are they buying when they vote? It can be something rather nasty.
Yeah. Edgar Voigtwanger's memoir is called Hitler, My Neighbor. His story's worth thinking about today, because for the first time since the Second World War, far-right, neo-fascist groups are gaining ground and winning votes all over Europe. So this hour, we're talking about what it's like to discover and face up to hatred in your own backyard.
Predappio is a city that few people have heard of because it's a rather small town. It's only 6,400 inhabitants. But its greatest claim to fame is that it's where Benito Mussolini, the Italian dictator, was born, and where he's also buried.
This is Ilaria Maria Sala. She's an Italian journalist. And Predappio has been in the news lately because there are plans to build Italy's first museum of fascism there. But the town is already a pilgrimage place for neo-fascist groups, and there are even local shops that cater to them.
I was shocked. I was completely speechless. Even the window display is brutal. Every imaginable object has been decorated, if I can use this word, with fascist symbols, fascist slogans, Mussolini's face, baby rompers with sentences from Mussolini, objects like this type of stick that was used by fascist gangs to beat up opponents, apologists, films, books.
Are these like tourist items? Are they just sort of meant to be jokes? Or are they things people buy because they really admire Mussolini?
I don't think you could take it as a joke, because in 1952, Italy passed a law called the Scelba Law that makes apology of fascism illegal. I went in and I asked one of the shop assistants why he was selling these things, who was buying them. And of course, he could see from my expression that I was not a supporter. And he said, these are things that are bought by people who have no prejudices. And I was like, well, I don't think that's a prejudice. Isn't this in breach of the law? And he said, I don't think I'm doing anything against the law. I pay taxes, blah, blah, blah. Now, those who go to these shops are not local people. They get pretty full on the birthday, the day of his death, the day of the March on Rome.
What happens then?
On those days, you have neo-fascist groups. It used to be just a few tens of people going, and now there is many hundreds, sometimes a few thousand. They wear black shirts. They sing fascist songs. They parade with slogans against immigrants. It's an incitement to violence from beginning to end. And most of the time, their marches end in a crypt, which is where Mussolini is buried.
So the mayor of Predappio is very concerned about this. He doesn't want increasingly large crowds of neo-fascists showing up and marching through his city's streets. But his response seems kind of odd. He wants to start a museum of fascism. That just seems like throwing raw meat to the crowd.
Absolutely. Giorgio Frassinetti, the mayor of Predappio, he comes from the main center-left party in Italy, the Democratic Party. When I spoke with him, I felt that he was a bit at a loss and a bit confused. And that's because Italy has created this kind of legend about how much we fought fascism, how much we opposed it, which is not actually true. One thing that is, for example, to me absolutely astounding is how few Italians are aware of the fact that under fascism, Italy colonized Ethiopia, Eritrea. It's like we didn't study this at school. So there is this kind of collective amnesia or voluntary amnesia of what really happened. And the idea of Frassinetti to create this museum, to some extent, reflects this.
So what would go in this museum? And it sounds like it's intended to be more about the damage that fascism did rather than a museum celebrating fascism?
That's the idea. However, no matter what you do, you're going to end up, and that's one thing that Frassinetti kept telling me, of course there's going to be portraits. There's going to be a section about propaganda, which means that he's going to display the propaganda object. And so it is going to look like some kind of shrine.
I have to say, it's so interesting to hear you talk about this, because in the U.S., we're going through a period where Confederate and slavery markers are being removed, landmarks are being renamed. Is anything comparable happening in Italy? The country is full of buildings and monuments that were built by Mussolini and his fellow fascists.
That's right. And if you talk to any architect, they are actually considered to be extremely important, extremely interesting. They are historical monuments, but they're very flawed historical monuments because of the ideology that brought them to be. And for this, there seems to be hardly any willingness to say, okay, this stuff is toxic, let's destroy it. And the tendency seems to be today to say, yeah, you know, the Colosseum also was done by killing slaves, so why should we worry about fascist monuments that were done in the same way? It's like 2,000 years have passed for nothing. We are still doing the same thing and thinking that it's okay in order to somehow venerate beauty.
It's so interesting the way you're thinking about what it means to face hatred. You know, on the one hand, you're saying that the resurgence in fascism or neo-fascism has everything to do with not facing up to the hatred of the past, not looking at it. And at the same time, you're talking about wanting not to face signs and symbols of hatred, wanting to erase some of those. So it's such an interesting dilemma.
Absolutely. And it's even more troubling today because this kind of irresponsible way of looking at it has really allowed a resurgence of hatred today in Italy, as we are witnessing these days, attacks against immigrants, very weak response from the authorities and from political parties. Now the police is allowing neo-fascist groups to have demonstrations in Italian squares and Italian main roads, which used not to be allowed. And when anti-fascist groups require the same permit, the explanation that they are given is that, no, they can't march against neo-fascist groups because this would be a provocation and the best thing is just to let them die in darkness and it will all go away. The thing is, it hasn't gone away. It's not going away. It's actually become stronger in darkness. It's very scary and it does give you a sense of despair because if anyone should know what fascism was about, that has to be Italy. We've lived it in first person. And letting shrines like Predappio become this new focus of pilgrimages is it's good to be worried. It's the only thing that one can be. We have to be worried and we have to talk about it.
Ilaria Maria Sala is an Italian journalist currently based in Hong Kong. So does it matter if a few neo-fascist groups pop up in Italy? Well, the thing is, it's not just in Italy. Right-wing nationalists have been winning votes in Germany and in the Netherlands, and there's a Dutch philosopher, Rob Riemann, who's been warning lately that contemporary fascism is just beginning. And he says the U.S., under President Trump, is part of this swing toward a fascist mindset. Now, Steve Paulson wondered if Riemann isn't being a little too free with that F word.
Rob, we generally think of fascism in historical terms, something that more or less ended with Hitler and Mussolini, but you say fascism is once again on the rise. Where do you see it?
I see it in many places in Europe and also here in the United States of America. But it's a quite odd idea to think that fascism could have disappeared. I mean, it's a very strange mistake. Great intellectuals, authors like Thomas Mann and Albert Camus, warned us already after World War II in 1947. They said, please don't make the mistake, this war is over. But fascism did not disappear. Hmm. Why is it that they made this claim? Because they realized very, very well that fascism is the anti-democratic spirit. It's the political expression of the worst of human instincts. The phenomenon of fascism is not based on an ideology because there is no ideology. There is no positive idea behind it.
This is not a clearly thought-out vision of the future. It's something else.
Yeah, it's the exploitation of the worst sentiments in us human beings. And a mass democracy is different by fear, greed, desires, and it opens the gate for demagogues and populist, charismatic figures who are functioning as a kind of false messiahs because fascism is a form of a secular religion. Hmm. That's what it is. That's also, you know, why people want to believe in this strong man. Most of the time it's a strong man who present himself as the anti-politician leader who will cure society of all social evils.
Now, usually the label that is used to identify some of these people, and we should get to specifics in a moment, is they are populists.
Yeah.
But you sort of object to that word. I mean, you say that's often a dodge, that's a cop-out, that we don't actually call it for what it is.
Yeah, well, look, Donald Trump was a populist and Bernie Sanders was a populist. Barack Obama was also a populist. If everybody is a populist, then nobody is a populist. Now, this whole notion of populism is indeed a kind of euphemism to avoid the F word. People like Mussolini, Hitler, the worst examples, could make their fascist career because they were very charismatic leaders and people had a holy faith. They knew how to speak. But again, next to that come all the other things. Fascism is the final political expression of the anti-democratic spirit, which will present itself as the anti-politician, will battle the free press, will make judges suspect, or what you're having here now is make the FBI suspect, will be authoritarian and will be constantly in need because, again, there are no positive ideas. He has to create a crisis and he has to exploit the forms of resentment and fear and hatred in a society to activate the base.
So you're saying there's not a clear ideology of, okay, this is what we want to do with the country. It's more, it's a series of resentments and hatred.
It's all technique. That's why it's a tremendous mistake to think we can only recognize fascism if it looks like, as we have seen it, in black uniforms with jilly jesters, as we saw it in the 30s and the 40s. That's not the case. What is the case is that at the time of Stalin, the people in the Soviet Union, Pasternak, Akhmatova, Mandelstam, they all spoke in terms of, so we are dealing here with Soviet fascism. Mm-hmm. So for them,
so you're saying fascism can be on the left as well as on the right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, it's the anti-democratic spirit, and it's the spirit of people with a mindset who are only interested in themselves. It's all about their own power. For that, they create this fascist cult with its religious overtones, being the messiah who can do all the things. And again, if you remember how Trump announced his candidacy. He came from, quote-unquote, heaven, downstairs on the elevator. At the convention, he presented himself, you know, out of the darkness into the light. So you had all these things.
You're making a serious charge here. I mean, you're calling Donald Trump a fascist?
He's absolutely the man with a fascist mindset. But look, I mean, what is outrageous about it? We have the same thing in Hungary. We have it in Austria. We have it in Turkey. We have it in Russia. I mean, what's the problem with just telling the truth?
Well, because I think when we think about fascism or a fascist movement, there's this sense that it sweeps aside all governmental institutions. And, you know, Trump could very easily be voted out in 2020. We have, you know, elections. We have...
Sure. But Steve, you see what's happening with your institutions right now. Make the free press suspect. Make the judges suspect. Because, quote unquote, they are all the enemy of the people. And Mr. Trump is the greatest representative of the people, whatever that may be. The institutions are as strong as the people are. But the base behind every institution is trust. And when trust is gone, the institutions will go at the end of the day itself. This was the great message which a German immigrant in 1938, the Nobel Prize winner Thomas Mann, gave when he, here in America, went on a coast-to-coast town hall lecture tour talking about the common victory of democracy. And he said to the Americans at that time, please listen to me. I come from Munich. I've seen the rise of a fascist movement in my hometown with Mr. Hitler and then spreading all over Europe. Don't make the mistake. Fascism can invade the whole democratic system, which then will collapse.
And didn't Thomas Mann say that fascism will rise in America in the name of freedom?
Yes, because the very important strategy of all leaders with a fascist mindset is the politics of lies. They are pathological liars, all of them. And so it will come in the name of freedom or democracy. They know how to use the rhetoric. They know how to use the slogans. They are in need of the propaganda machines.
So I want to come back to the word again, because I guess maybe I'm getting hung up on trying to actually label some of these politicians fascists. The word that's used for a lot of these people who are coming to power, including Donald Trump, is authoritarian. Or, you know, look at some other countries and the word strongman is used. Mm-hmm. People tend to avoid that word fascism because it is so loaded. It is so connected to the historical legacy of Hitler and Mussolini mm-hmm. in particular. Why are you so insistent on calling these people fascists?
It's not that difficult to understand that if you see what has happened in Europe. World War One, which started out of the blue for no good reason by the killing of a crown prince on the 28th of June 1914, and a couple of months later the whole thing was set on fire. Then we got the rise of the fascist movements in Germany, Italy, France, Spain, Central Europe, the Netherlands, and so on and so forth. What I want people to understand is that the development which we are seeing now in Western Europe and in America is the rise of this anti-democratic spirit, and that it will come with consequences. And the consequences are indeed violence. Now, this is the big counter-argument. Rob, you cannot speak about fascism because the violence is not there. Well, hang on. You do not need a PhD in psychology to understand that if you keep inciting fear and hatred and divisiveness in a society, at a certain moment, the society will explode. Look, human nature did not change, okay? And Freud already explained to us how aggressive we human beings are. If we add to that a kind of politics which focuses again and again and again on our worst instincts, violence will happen. Do I have to remember people of what happened in the Balkans mm-hmm. in the 90s, where you have Milosevic and other people who could set their country on fire with ethnic cleansing and all the things that happened, or what happened in Rwanda? Please don't make the mistake and don't think that the United States of America is such an exception to human nature that it cannot happen here.
So let's talk about possible solutions, not just from your perspective voting out Donald Trump, but it sounds like you're saying that the United States at this moment in its history is just ripe for the takeover of this fascist mindset. How do we reverse course?
If we understand what the root of this crisis is, that this fascist culture comes from inside the society, right? It's not imposed on people. Mm-hmm. It comes from inside the democracy. Then the first thing to be done is to regain the democratic spirit. As Thomas Mann spoke about it in 1938, we said, well, the democratic spirit is that spirit, again, which wants to elevate people, to make them better than they are, and to have them live a life which is focused on the human dignity for every human being. And therefore, you need truth, you need justice, you need beauty, you need compassion, you need empathy, which is the opposite of our commercial culture, which is constantly focused on what is efficient, productivity. It's this ongoing materialism, and everything has to be useful, useful, useful.
Wait. So, I mean, I have to say, if the problem is the materialism of our culture, and that is what is corrupting our politics, God help us. We live in this very materialist culture, and that's kind of alarming.
We can change things, but what we are desperately in need of is a new counterculture. 50 years after 68, we are in need of a new counterculture. And that will not be a flower power thing, but it will be a culture which brings us back to the recognition of the fact that, quote-unquote, man does not live by bread alone. What makes our life meaningful? How can we have a society which is focused on the common good for everybody instead of a society which is only focused on what's good for me, 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 me?
That's Dutch philosopher Rob Riemann talking with Steve Paulson about his book To Fight Against This Age on Fascism and Humanism. So, how about some good news? I could use a little hope right now, couldn't you? Coming up, a story of personal change.
I was working full time, and I figured if I ate nothing but ramen noodles, I would have more drinking money. The one day I ate something aside from ramen noodles was payday, and I would go to McDonald's and I'd get a Big Mac meal. I kind of froze in the doorway. Behind the counter was an elderly black woman working. She had this beaming, amazing smile. She's asking me about my day. She's just super nice and pleasant. And it made things really difficult for me as I'm trying to hate black people. I got this swastika tattooed on my middle finger of my right hand. This was by design so that when people reflected my hostility, I could show them my middle finger on my right hand before closing into a fist and hitting them. This gut reaction I had was like, I don't want her to see this tattoo. And I sat there for a minute thinking, does anybody else work here? Where are there other McDonald's? It was pretty far and it was cold out, so the siren song of the Big Mac ultimately prevailed, and I'm thinking I'm just going to keep my hand in my pocket. She won't see the swastika. But she saw it as I was getting my money out. What is that on your finger? I just looked down at my boots, and I was a good foot taller than her at the time, but I felt like 6 inches high when she asked me that. She waited until I looked up again, and when I did and our eyes met, she said, "That's not who you are. I know you're a better person than that."
Unlearning hatred when we come back. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
woke up that morning. It was a Sunday morning. It was a beautiful Sunday morning in August. I was just getting my kids ready for Sunday school. My wife had gone to work already, and we were going to meet up with my wife later.
This is Pardeep Kalika.
My daughter tends to lollygag when she gets ready, so I'm always kind of hurrying her along. We left the house, and about 5 minutes or 10 minutes later, she tells me that she left her Sunday school notebook at the house. My initial reaction was just to keep going forward and just explain to the teacher that she forgot her notebook. But she was pretty insistent, so we turned back around, and, you know, luckily we did. She went back, she got her notebook, we got back on the freeway and continued on to the Gurdwara, Sikh Temple, Wisconsin. From our peripheral, saw a bunch of squad cars from different jurisdictions going past us. Lights and sirens, high rate of speed. Maybe about a mile or half a mile from the Sikh Temple, a police officer barricaded the street. So I pulled over to the side, got out of my car, and asked the police officer, "Sir, what's going on?" He looks at me and tells me that there's been a shooting at the temple. I heard what he had to say, but it was just so surreal that I needed him to say it again for me to process it.
There's been a shooting at the temple.
I try to convince him to allow me to get through. I tell him, you know, my mom and dad are both inside that temple. He's not having any of it. I ask him, I said, "When did this shooting happen?" 10 minutes ago.
There's been a shooting at the temple.
In that moment, I just remember this extreme sense of relief for myself and my kids that my daughter forgot that notebook at the house. But I also had this extreme sense of guilt, this roller coaster ride of emotions. Who was safe, who was not. Eventually, by the end of the day, we would find out that Dad was one of the 6 victims, and that he wouldn't make it.
Pardeep Kalika's father was shot on August 5th, 2012. That was the day a 40-year-old white man, Wade Michael Page, attacked the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. He killed 6 people, including Pardeep's father. Now, in the aftermath, Pardeep tried to process what had happened. And as it happens, he's actually a trauma therapist himself, so he knows something about facing pain. And he wound up reaching out in this extraordinary way to a former white supremacist, a guy named Arno Michaelis, who was one of the original founders of the hate group that the temple shooter belonged to. Arno had left that world. By this time, he was spending a lot of time as an anti-Nazi, trying to deprogram young skinheads. And so 2 months after the massacre, these 2 men met at a local Thai restaurant, and they talked for hours. Charles Monroe Kane asked them to tell their story.
Pardeep, you reached out to Arno only a few months after the massacre. Why?
You know, one word answer is understanding. I think a lot of times we do things and we think that we understand. And we take stuff as gospel, as far as like somebody telling us something, and we echo chamber ourselves. We build silos from these echo chambers, and we do this subconsciously, that it was very important for me to reach out to somebody who can give me the authenticity that this tragedy deserved. I wanted to reach out to understand, and I also had a feeling that Arno had the same feelings that I did. And so I believed in that spirit, and I reached out to Arno, and I met at the restaurant, and I definitely got a better understanding of why the shooter did what he did. But more importantly than that, I gained a friend. that would be an ally going forward for our community.
You know, Arno, I got to interrupt and ask a question to you if you can answer it honestly for me. What were you before you changed?
I actually made Wade Pagely pretty tame. I started a white power skinhead gang in Milwaukee with some friends of mine. That gang linked up with other white power skinhead gangs around the country. And today, that skinhead gang is the largest organized white power skinhead group on earth. For 7 years, I lived that life, and I recruited people. I specifically looked for wounded white kids, kids who had been through some trauma. They were the ones who were most ripe for our message. I recruited vehemently all the time, and if you didn't get recruited by me, I was just as happy to break your face for you. And I got in street fights constantly. I would attack pretty much anybody arbitrarily at any given time just for the thrill of violence. And I was a lead vocal for a very popular white power band. In many ways, I was exactly who Wade Page used to be. He was part of the same gang I had helped to start. He was also in white power bands. I would be stunned if he had never heard of my band, and I would not be surprised if he was a fan of the music that I made, screaming at people to go and murder each other because of the color of their skin.
I can't imagine. I mean, you're a former white supremacist. What was it like to get an email from Pardeep? I mean, that must have been incredible. What was that like?
I was actually super excited. I was really honored. In the week following August 5th, I did a ton of media. I was doing media like 8 to 10 hours a day from all over the world because I had been doing peace education work as like a former white supremacist for a couple of years already at that point, and I already had a pretty high profile. And I had real mixed feelings about all the media I was doing because I was in this transition point where I was going from being an IT consultant to being a professional speaker, author. And honestly, nothing better could have happened to my prospective career than the Sikh temple shooting.
Wow.
And the entire time I'm doing all these interviews, I've just wanted to go back to rebooting servers if it could have brought these six people back. But at the same time, there's always a part of me internally that wants to beat myself up for who I was and what I've done. And that part of me was very much at the forefront, right, saying like, oh, good job, Arno. Why don't you go get some speaking gigs and sell some books? Because six people are dead.
Pardeep, I wonder at this point when you guys are having dinner together, were you aware of how far behind Arno had put his past? And was that part of the reason you wanted to talk to him?
No, at this point, I really wasn't aware how far his history was, or like, you know, if you put it in the past even.
So you didn't know that he had really changed?
No. I mean, I had, you know, wow. I kind of had a hunch that he changed. But as the dinner date was getting closer and closer and closer, and as I shared with family and friends what I was about to do and who I was about to talk to.
I would assume your mom did not like that at all.
No, mom didn't like that. My wife didn't like that. There's people who were in the Sikh community who had just gone through this.
Pardeep, what did you get out of meeting with Arno? It seems like he was a racist, violent man, kind of the opposite of who you were. It's like, it seems like you have a lot to offer him, but what does he get out of that for you?
So, I mean, just come back to understanding. If you don't understand why somebody would be able to do something like this and have answers, I don't think that you can genuinely process and heal. You can fake it. I was definitely faking it after August 5th because I knew we had to put on a brave face for the world. For me, Arno has been my greatest therapist. And I am a therapist. So I could say he's been my brother, my confidant. We've had a lot of battles together. And these battles are political. These battles are personal. But as far as, like, you know, why we find ourselves there together, I believe in the divine spirit. And I believe somehow, some way, the divine spirit brought us together.
Arno, how do you, when you're having dinner with him and then you become friends, work together, how do you not just feel guilty all the time for your past? I'm just curious how you don't aren't just overcome by guilt every time you see him.
I want to make a positive impact in the world. I understand that if I'm beating myself up And if I'm drowning in guilt for what I've done, that it diminishes my capacity to have a positive impact in the world.
Yeah.
And not that I don't deserve to beat myself up. And I've spent a very long time doing that.
I bet.
And I felt that I deserved nothing but suffering. I did not deserve love. I did not deserve happiness because of what I had done and because of who I was. And Pardeep has taught me that that doesn't help anybody. That doesn't honor his father. It doesn't honor the other five lives left on August 5th. It doesn't honor anybody who's suffering if I'm tormenting myself like this. What does honor them is when I am out cultivating compassion and kindness and forgiveness in society, because those qualities are what makes our society one that's less conducive to the kind of violence that happened on August 5th.
You know, Pardeep, your philosophy and what you and Arno work on, it seems that it's about compassion, forgiveness, but it seems to put a lot of pressure on the victim, which would be you in this instance, to be a part of the solution. Like, is that always the best way to do this?
Well, I mean, I'll speak for myself on this. I wanted that pressure. When we give pressure to somebody, we also give power. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about reclaiming a sense of power. And we want to make it that forgiveness is not really about forgetting. And the forgiveness is a survivor's vengeance against what happened to them and their ability to come back from that. And even the first time, I know that Arno talked a lot about who he used to be and all the bad things that he used to be. But the first time that I saw Arno, I didn't see all that. I saw a person that was still suffering and still in pain. And when we can see that, we can see the humanity within each other. And first and foremost, Sikhism teaches is to see that God-like spirit within the next person, that the spirit is alive in every person. Mm-hmm. And if I'm really going to be a Sikh, I have to see that same spirit in the shooter, Wade Michael Page. I have to see that this person was actually a person and not a monster. And I have to understand that it's different that we're fighting against racism or racists, because racists is a people. Yeah. And when we personalize it to say, you know what, it's that person, and we don't understand the suffering and the pain that has caused that, then we're just washing our hands of being the solution or ever solving anything like that.
You know, that's the most beautiful thing I've heard in a really long time. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joel.
That's Charles Monroe Kane talking with Pardeep Kalika and Arno Michaelis. You can read more about their journey in their forthcoming book called The Gift of Our Wounds, A Sikh and a Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness. They've also co-founded the group Serve to Unite, which works to create climates of compassion and nonviolence. Coming up, doctrines of hatred get spread in some surprising ways, even in literature. Well, that's probably not the right term for this book.
Saddam Hussein had written a romance novel, Zabiba and the King. What kind of romance novel does a kind of murderous dictator write?
What was it like?
It's fairly terrible. It's set in like the early Islamic period, and there's a pagan king who falls in love with a young Muslim woman, and they have very, very long political discourses. She instructs him on the art of leadership. So there's that going on, but simultaneously there's a sort of Thousand and One Nights type narrative structure. There's a grandmother who's talking to these children, telling them, oh, I'll tell you the story of this king. But then there's wildly inappropriate content. Scenes of rape, weird description of bestiality in northern Iraq. Even in translation, you can tell this is no masterpiece.
What kind of books do murderous dictators write? Evidently not very good ones. We'll find out more after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Thank you.
Fascist dictators don't only murder millions of people, they also write books. Daniel Calder spent 8 years reading the collected writings of some of the world's most notable tyrants, so you and I don't have to. So tell us about your dictator's library. What's on the shelves?
Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler, and then Chairman Mao, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, Ayatollah Khomeini, North Korean dictators, Fidel Castro, and I have a look at Putin's judo manual.
I just, who would have guessed that all these dictators would have written books? Would you call it a literary tradition? Because we could call it dick lit.
That's what I called it, dick lit, after chick lit, which was a trend right. at the time. I thought, man, there's actually like a dictatorial canon, if you will. It's not just random incidents of like a guy writes a book. They have huge bibliographies. They're aware of each other as writers.
I was going to ask, do they read each other?
Certainly in the early days, they were acutely aware of each other. I mean, I know Mussolini read Mein Kampf and he thought it was atrocious. Hitler was a big fan of Mussolini. Stalin's oeuvre, for want of a better word, a lot of it is quotations from Lenin. Or even a guy like Gaddafi, he called his book The Green Book. This was just 2 or 3 years after Chairman Mao had released The Red Book. Mm. They're kind of jockeying for position as leaders of the world revolution.
I just can't imagine what it would be like to read all of this. As far as I can tell, you didn't just read their big books. You read everything they wrote.
I didn't read everything they wrote. I mean, if you were to read everything Lenin wrote, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. Mm-hmm. And when they were revolutionaries, yes, they wrote their own stuff. But once they became dictators, they started to cheat.
Did they just have their peons write their works for them?
Some of them did and some of them didn't. So in North Korea, yeah, it was like a factory production line. But some of them, you'd be very surprised. Stalin was very hands-on. Mm-hmm. He was astoundingly hands-on. I would say he was the chief editor of the Soviet Union. And so so there was a very famous book, The Short Course, it was called. It was a history of the Communist Party. And Stalin, this was sort of created because they'd murdered so many people and erased so many people from history. It was a real problem that they had all these books floating around with non-persons or people who had suddenly you couldn't mention. So they decided to standardize history. So Stalin commissioned this book, The Short Course. In the archives, you can see, you know, his editorial pencil on just page after page after page. And he wasn't just making comments about, oh, you know, give us a bit more about Lenin here. It was a kind of line editing and copy editing and a choice of word. And so he was like a line editor from hell. And that's astounding when you think of, I mean, he was a murderous tyrant running a country. I guess it shows how significant he thought the books were.
I can imagine this would be a really stimulating, engaging intellectual project to take on. Did it have an emotional effect on you? I mean, what did it feel like to read all this stuff?
That's a good question. It was stupefyingly boring. For example, Mein Kampf was extremely difficult to read. But I read it in chunks, in pieces. It's clearly the work of a murderous fanatic. If you haven't read Mein Kampf, it's everything you imagine it could be. Raw hatred and violence. But for me, this was something that I wouldn't say I welcomed it. But like I say, so I lived in Russia for like 9 or 10 years. And I had a lot of friends there. And I arrived after the Soviet Union collapsed. But they often spoke about the mind-numbing boredom of the Soviet Union. Hmm. And so for me, as I read these books, I was interested in them as a kind of a portal into this boredom. After doing it for a couple of years, I developed a sort of, I became inured. Just kind of, I could keep going.
And some of these books are still in circulation and still read today. I think Mein Kampf, which was not even allowed to be published in Germany from the war years until about 2016, but it's really popular in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mein Kampf taps into an ancient hatred. If you look at like some of the communist things, they're sort of, they're millenarian, but it's tied to this theory that's very difficult to read. Whereas Mein Kampf, the theory's gibberish, but it just taps much more into these evil emotions that I think it kind of encourages in people.
One lesson I took away from reading about some of this stuff is all these guys, all the dictators, they all wanted to be writers, and often they started writing when they were still just young revolutionaries. But what they wrote was terrible. You know, as you said, it was boring, it was hard to read, it wandered all over the place. And yet, those books took over really quickly. They would go from writing some boring political tract to suddenly having vast political power over the course of a decade. Could that happen again today, or was that really just a feature of the time?
I don't think anybody expected it to happen then. And that's what also kept occurring to me, was like, wow, you know, there was the Bolsheviks, there was barely any of them. Like, in their first Congress was like 9 or 10 or 11. 20 years later, they're in charge of the largest country on the planet. It's not just enough to write a book. When the Bolsheviks appeared, there was World War I. Tsardom was rotten. There was like economic crisis. So you need to have a cluster of these things in place. And then you need to have like a guy who knows how to seize the moment. Lenin, he absolutely understood how to seize the moment. But there were other authors in Hungary and Germany who attempted the same thing and didn't succeed. So you might see, well, this is a marginal and completely ridiculous idea, and it's believed by just a handful of people. But that's no sign they're not going to be successful given the right conditions. So do I think it's going to happen again? I don't anticipate it, but at the same time, things can happen very quickly. Disgruntled intellectuals with bizarre ideas can be much more dangerous than they appear, but we don't know which ones.
Daniel Calder. His guide to the classics of authoritarian literature is just out. It's called The Infernal Library. And that's it for this hour. Thanks for listening. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Mark Rickers, and Halima Shah. Our resident sonic genius and TD is Joe Hartke. Our mild-mannered and completely unauthoritarian EP is Steve Paulson. And I'm Anne Strangechamps. Have a good week, and remember, knowledge is power.